You're listening to I'm Ready for My Close-Up on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Alex Fitch, and in this week's show, I'm delighted to be talking to veteran fantasy film director Joe Dante. Dante is best known for a string of inventive horror and fantasy films in the late 70s and 80s, such as The Howling, Piranha, Gremlins, Innerspace, and The Burbs, and is the guest of honour at this weekend's cult film festival, Cine Excess, at the Odeon Covent Garden Cinema on Shaftesbury Avenue in London. Last night at Cine Excess, they premiered a new cut of Dante's sophomoric film, The Movie Orgy, a mashup of found footage that got the director his first professional job in the industry as an editor before going on to direct films. So I'm talking to him about the new 90-minute cut of his first movie, how this film was created, his love of cinema in general, and subversive themes in his work. First, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner. FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
I'm talking to director Joe Dante. You're the guest of honour at this year's Cine Excess Festival, and they're premiering a collection of your short films from the 1960s that you've edited together to make a feature. Could you tell me how that came about?
Well, that's not quite the quite the case. What they're running is they're running a film called The Movie Orgy. It was the first film that I ever did. It used to run 7 hours. It is made entirely of found footage. Okay. It's not a series of shorts. It's just a series of stuff. It came about because in the late 60s, there was a lot of interest in, quote, camp movies. Mm. Susan Sontag's essay had come out, and people were discussing the issue. And the 1943 Batman serial was released as an entire package. So you would go and you would sit in the theater and you'd watch 5 hours of chapter plays, and you would see the all the cheating that went on from the end of chapter two to the beginning of chapter three. Wait a minute, he got hit by a truck at the end of chapter two, but in the beginning of chapter three, he rolls away from the truck. And they, because they figured after the week went by, the kids wouldn't remember. Mm. Anyway, it was very funny. And it was also interestingly very racist because it was a World War II production. And there was something about the idea of sitting through all 5 hours of it that made you a little crazy. And the audience really loved it. So for some reason, I decided that I would do something similar. And I put together a serial. I got a copy of the serial, The Phantom Creeps, Bela Lugosi, and started intercutting it with other footage from other sources and ran it at the Philadelphia College of Art to great acclaim. Everybody was happy. And my friend John Davison and I decided to sort of take this concept of running a bunch of stuff for all those hours and put together our own film. So we went to, he was at NYU at the time, and we had a screening at NYU of what was then called The Movie Orgy. It was 7 hours long. It consisted of several features, which we would run on one projector. And then whenever it got boring, we would cut out of that projector and we would go to this reel of stuff that we had prepared that could be run up until we managed to scroll down on the other projector to the next scene that was worth seeing. And so we would reduce every movie to like maybe 40 minutes or 30 minutes by just cutting out stuff. And we would take different plots and we would cross them and take movies where actors played similar parts and make it look like it was all one movie. This eventually turned into a very profitable enterprise for us because the Schlitz Beer Company saw one of the presentations at the Columbia University and decided they wanted to sponsor us and let us send this film around to college campuses. And they would give free beer, and they'd give us $100 for every showing. And we had, you got to remember, this is one 16-millimeter print consisting of lots of different footage from different movies, all with different levels of focus and different sound levels. And it had to be, you had to ride it with the projector. You had to literally refocus every time there was a splice. And there were like 2,000 splices.
Wow. Did they break from time to time?
On occasion, it would break, and then we would, but we would always have two projectors so we could switch to the other projector while we fixed something. Cool. We had an ad that made up called it a 2001 Splice Odyssey. And this was a compendium of things that our audience, which was college kids in the late 60s, hadn't seen in years, like old TV shows from when they were kids. And John and I were both 16 millimeter film collectors, and so we had amassed this bunch of stuff. Commercials from years gone by, pieces of films, pieces of industrial films, trailers, anything we could find. And they would be all cut together with a sort of point to it. It's difficult to describe without seeing it, but it became quite popular and actually sort of put me through the Roger Corman School of Filmmaking while I was working for Roger for no money. We were still making money by sending this film around. And then it was dormant for many years, and I happened to come across it in my garage, and I thought, I wonder if it still runs. And I ran it, and I thought, you know, this is really getting beat up, and the sprockets are torn. I should make a copy of this on video before it's too late. So I did, and we ran it at the New Beverly Cinema in Los Angeles, and of course we couldn't charge admission because I don't have the rights to any of the stuff that's in here, and some of it I don't even know what it is. And for whatever reason, it was this phenomenon. I mean, people turned out for it. There were lines around the block. It's one of those projects that's been talked about in movie blogs for years, and it was listed on the IMDb with a question mark after it, and it was this mysterious movie that people seemed to remember seeing, but no one knew where it was. And we got this tremendous turnout, and celebrities came, and everybody thought it was hilarious, and so we brought it back again the next year, and then last year we ran it in Venice at the Venice Film Festival, and there were some scholarly treatises written about it, which is always pretty funny. And so we don't have the time to run the entire film here, so what I've done is I've made a sort of a highlight reel of 90 minutes worth of what is now a five-hour movie. It was once 7 hours, but then pieces kept getting lost, and so I thought I'd better make a copy of it while I've got most of it. And we'll see how it goes over. I mean, it's very American. It's very baby boomer-centric. There's a lot of things in it that I don't know if it'll travel across the pond, although in Venice they seem to get most of it. And some of it's in very bad taste, although I don't think we're running any of that stuff. And it's very anti-military because, of course, there are attitude at the moment that this is during the Vietnam War, and so it's we're very down on all that stuff. I'll be curious to see what the reaction is. It sort of stops in the middle and just says to be continued in case anybody ever wants a return engagement.
Well, I suppose this audience also is partially an education audience because it ties in with Brunel's cult cinema course. So I suppose for them it's as much an exercise in seeing footage from the time that could have been lost anyway.
Yeah, I think if anything fits the definition of cult movie, this would. And I'm only sorry we can't run the whole thing because I do feel that it plays better the more groggy you are. It was sort of designed to be walked out on. Okay. The idea being that if you had decided to get a pizza and come back, you hadn't missed anything. In this version, we have some of the highlights of the things that people have thought were very funny. But I'm not so sure that they aren't funnier if you've been sitting for 4 hours before they come on than they are if you've only been sitting for 40 minutes.
And you said you didn't know what some of the footage was. Is that because when you were researching the film, you were literally opening up cans of film, not knowing what it was, holding it up to the light and go, oh, this looks interesting?
Well, actually, we had all these pieces from a film library that went out of business. And so we would just put them up on the projector and we'd run them. If there was something funny, we'd make a note of what it was. And then we'd try to find something to cut to from it or before it. And then we'd put it in. I used to tape them to the wall with little notes and stuff. There's a lot of things in it that just defy identification. I just don't know what they are. They're little pieces from movies that I don't recognize the actors. I don't recognize the sets. Usually I'm pretty good at being able to tell at cold what movie something is from. But in this case, there's some things that have just eluded me. And there's also some commercials that are for products that are no longer being made that are very campy and very funny. And you get an idea of what a different world it is now from the one that we grew up in.
Cool. And you put this film together about a decade before you directed your first film. So in constructing some sort of narrative or at least, you know, themes in editing together this footage, did it teach you some of the I don't know, the rules of filmmaking in terms of cutting one scene to the next?
Well, I don't think I probably could have gotten my job editing trailers for Roger Corman if I hadn't done this film first, because this was true primitive cutting. I mean, we couldn't mix it, so we had to use whatever sound was there. When you make a splice, the sound overlaps, so you had to account for that. And I had no movie viewer. I didn't have any kind of help. So I had to literally put each piece up on the projector, mark it, take it down and splice it, put it back up on the projector. It's astonishing that the film even exists. I mean, it was beat up so much. But when I did end up making trailers for Roger, I fell back on some of the same techniques that I had used when I was cutting this film.
Many of the films you then went on to make as a director have a nostalgic element to them, sort of referencing old monster movies from the 50s, 60s, and so on. What sort of films were you watching when you started off as a director?
Well, I've always been interested in all kinds of films. I mean, when I was a kid, I spent my Saturday afternoons at the movies, and I spent as much time in front of the TV watching old movies as I was allowed to. And being a movie buff, there are no old movies. There are just movies, and movies you haven't seen. And so when I came to work for Roger, I had started collecting 16mm film by then, so I had my own collection, and a lot of films that you couldn't see elsewhere, I had prints of. So I didn't feel like I was deprived. Most people, if they didn't see a movie on TV when it was on, they had to wait another year for it to be shown. If they didn't see it in the theater, they had to wait a couple of years for it to go on television. And then when it went on television, it was all cut up and it was in black and white. And the ease with which people can now access the film-going experience is remarkable to those of us who had to suffer through the lean years, where movies really weren't taken very seriously and they were just stuff to run between commercials. When I came out to California, that was pretty much the way it was. Old movies were on at night, interrupted by used car commercials, and they thought nothing about cutting off the first 10 minutes of the movie because that was the easiest way to make it shorter and not run the credits and not identify the movie in between, so you had no way to know what you were watching. It was a different world. And then when the video cassette came in and the idea of actually owning movies, where anybody could have a movie if they could just, you know, buy it or rent it, that sort of changed the whole equation for me, because I was used to sort of having the only way to see 8.5 for my friends, because I had a print. Now all of a sudden they could get a cassette of it. I still have movies on 16mm that I think will never come out on DVD or video. But for the most part, that technology is completely gone. They don't make prints anymore. They don't make the projectors anymore. They don't make the lenses. And yet there are a number of movies that they would never have found the missing pieces of if they hadn't had somebody's 16mm collection. So 16 was a really great thing to be into, but as a collector's medium, it's pretty much on its way out. Every so often you see people selling their collections because they've transferred them to video, but now they don't have to, because most movies are on video. And you don't have to get them in 16. And a lot of times the prints on video are better than the ones in 16 because they're from TV stations and they're kind of beat up and they've got scratches and splices. It's a great time to see movies. The problem is that there are so many old movies to see that nobody knows what they are because they're not in the zeitgeist. When I was a kid on TV, they were always running old movies. People talked about old movies. Old movies weren't old. They were just movies. Now that we have access to so many of these old pictures, the problem is that people need to be directed to them. They need to know about them, and that's why I started my website, Trailers from Hell, which is an attempt to try to get people familiar with movies that they may not even know exist.
So do you get people coming to you saying, I remember this scene from a movie, do you know which one it comes from, sort of thing?
Well, sure. A lot of people get that. There are people who remember seeing Psycho in color, and there are a lot of people who remember a lot of things that didn't really happen. And there's a lot of film scholarship now that there wasn't before. You had to carry things around in your head or write them down. Now it's all on the internet, and there's sites to go to, which are largely accurate, you know, sometimes not, but there's a lot of material out there that you can access. But again, you have to know what you're looking for. You have to have some sense. It's like it's not like everybody needs to go to film school, but people just need to know that that people did exist who made some pretty interesting movies that you haven't heard of because they're in black and white.
When a lot of people think of old films, well, sorry, films in general, it's quite often the climactic scene that, you know, sticks in their memory. For example, King Kong at the top of the Empire State Building being shot at by planes. Were there any sort of climactic scenes that sort of stuck in your head that when you were thinking of becoming a filmmaker, you thought, I want to end a movie like that because that's a climax, a finale that sticks in people's heads?
I wish I could say that I did. I mean, I didn't necessarily find the finales of the movie to be the be-all and end-all of the movie. I mean, for me, I just had to be sucked into the story. And it depended on how old I was when I saw a movie. I went to a lot of pictures when I was a kid at Saturday matinees that bored the hell out of me because they were all adults in boardrooms talking, you know. And then I later find out that these are, like, great movies. But I was just too young to appreciate them. And I think you find that you go through different periods of your life and there are certain kinds of things that interest you. And then you may revisit an old movie that you saw when you were a kid and now you discover that it's kind of tacky. Or more excitingly, you discover that a movie you liked as a kid actually has a lot of extra hidden value now that you're an adult. You know, there are certain films like Eight and a Half that as a filmmaker, I can say that when you see the film and you're a teenager, it's one film. And then you see the film and you're in your 20s, it's another film. And then if you actually get to make films, then it's a different film. And then you get to be a little older and it's a different film. That's, I think, the mark of a real piece of art is something that changes with you. And you can find different things in at different times of your life.
Your first two films as a solo director, The Howling and Piranha, they were obviously both distributed by Roger Corman, and they were films aimed at a sort of older teenage adult audience. I guess that was because of the kind of films that he was distributing at the time. But I was wondering, since you started off making quote-unquote exploitation films, and then the fancy films you went on to direct, like Inner Space, Gremlins, Small Soldiers, were aimed at a sort of younger audience, moving from one sort of age group to another, was it because the family film in a way can be more subversive if you throw more ideas at it, while the horror film in general, because it has the shock factor, is a kind of easier prospect in filmmaking?
Well, the change that happens between the lower budget pictures and the higher budget pictures is not so much intent, because you always know who your audience is. Your audience for a picture like Piranha or The Howling is an audience of people who want a good time and want a scare and want a thrill. I happen to be lucky enough to be making those kind of pictures at a time when the industry suddenly decided that they were worth spending more money on. So what had been considered B pictures suddenly became A pictures, which made it a little harder for the B-picture producer to survive. But when I went on to do Gremlins, for instance, which is a more of a family audience movie than the first two I did, the origin of the movie was that it was supposed to be an R-rated horror film. And that Spielberg wanted to make it cheaply as the first film from his new company. And then as we worked on the movie, we discovered that it was probably going to be a little more expensive than they wanted it to spend, and that if it was had an R rating, that would cut down on the number of people who could see it, and so maybe they wanted to make it a little more family friendly. And so it became, and also while I worked on it, it went from a horror film to a comedy. But I don't see much difference in the way you make the picture. I mean, you basically know who your audience is, and you know that there's a certain point beyond which you probably shouldn't go for a certain kind of a movie. Although with Gremlins, it was a little touch and go because what we thought was family friendly, other people didn't when they saw the movie because it came out with a PG rating, and people complained, parents complained that the picture was too violent for their kids. I never heard a kid complain that it was too violent. Only parents, and you realize that kids are a little hipper about stuff like that than their parents are. I think one of the reasons that the picture has survived as a sort of a cult item is directly because of that. I mean, it is much edgier than similar kinds of films. And now I think it's, you know, probably suitable for an 8-year-old. But at the time when it came out, it probably wasn't suitable for an 8-year-old. But times have changed. The bigger pictures that I've done, even though they have been more expensive, have essentially basically really been B pictures. I mean, the types of pictures that I do are firmly based on the kind of movies that I loved when I was a kid. Mm. And because I and people of my generation love those kind of movies, they have now been exalted to a point where they're mainstream. Mm. And it happened with Star Wars and Jaws, mm. basically, and all of a sudden what used to be serials and Saturday matinee pictures now suddenly were, you know, playing at night and, you know, for large audiences. Mm. Some people have bemoaned that fact because up until that period, the late 60s, early 70s, there's a remarkable number of adult, intelligent, interesting films that were being done because the studios kind of didn't know where to go. When Easy Rider came out and all that money was being made by this mm. youth market, they didn't understand the youth market. You mean the teenagers? I mean the kids who watch those horror pictures and those beach party movies? All of a sudden, what was an AIP picture now had become a Warner Brothers picture or a mm. Paramount picture, and they were a little uneasy with that. They didn't really know quite what they were doing. Mm. And that's why a lot of people got away with a lot of good stuff. I mean, you can't imagine a picture like McCabe and Mrs. Miller being made for Warner Brothers today. Mm. It just wouldn't happen. But then once the Jaws and Star Wars phenomena happened and there was like, okay, now we get it. Now we know what we want to make. Mm. That's what's led to the tentpole mm. pictures that we have today.
Sure.
But I suppose what I was trying to get at was that with some of the films that you made in the 80s, like Gremlins and The Burbs, whether the fact that you were making a film that could be seen as slightly subversive, certainly at the time, for a family audience, was something that gave you more of a vicarious thrill as a filmmaker than, say, making something that you knew was targeted at an adult audience.
Well, I can't say that it gave me a vicarious thrill to sneak, you know, subversive messages into little children's movies. That subversive messages have always been there. I mean, yes. It's just part of who I am. Mm. I think all movies are political, whether they're mm. intended to be or not. That there's politics in everything in life, mm. and I like to think that you can see from my movies what my politics are, and that there are some underlying messages in some of these pictures that are not overt. Mm. In fact, I have really prided myself on not being particularly overt until I did a film for Masters of Horror called Homecoming, which was a anti-George Bush screed with no subtlety whatsoever, because I thought that's what the times demanded.
Yeah. Well, I was going to bring up Homecoming because you mentioned that some of the footage you chose for Movie Orgy was had an anti-Vietnam War theme to it. And then with Homecoming, you were one of the first filmmakers to make a film that commented on the dead returning from the Iraq War and very little media attention being given to them. And so you gave that a spin by turning them into zombies. I mean, at the time that you made Homecoming, were you quite angry as a filmmaker that people weren't addressing this theme? And if anyone's going to do something about it, because maybe genre audiences have a more open mind than people who see quote-unquote non-genre films, you could be the first person to tackle that issue.
Well, I will admit that the reason it came about was because I was angry. I was really sick of people buying the spin what I was seeing as craven cowardice. Mm. People that I knew had strong opinions about what was going on who were afraid to say anything. And this was an unusual opportunity in that the Masters of Horror series was based on the idea of getting established filmmakers to make these films in very brief amounts of time for no money by giving them creative freedom. So I figured that if I was going to be in this situation where I actually could do anything I wanted, I would take advantage of it and I would do this somewhat controversial piece. Mm. And I can't say that it was particularly successful because it didn't change anything, as things never do. Mm. I mean, if movies could really change the world, we would have all disarmed after Dr. Strangelove came out, but that didn't happen.
But certainly when it came out, it did generate a fair amount of debate on the internet. So it is possible that making it opened the door to other productions that then address that theme.
Well, I'd like to think it did some good in some area. I mean, I do know that I got a lot of hate mail, and people said they were burning their collections of Joe Dante movies because I didn't love my country, and all that nonsense that you get every time you try to say something about the way things are going. Mm. But I don't regret doing it. I think it's I was proud to get to do it. I was just lucky. I think there are a lot of other people in my position who would have done a similar kind of a film if they'd had the opportunity. I don't think that horror movie audiences are particularly more receptive to this sort of thing. In fact, I would say based on the mail I got, less receptive. I think they were a little annoyed that I was taking their time to make my political statement when all they wanted was some zombies. It did generate some controversy, and I did send a copy of it to all the right-wing pundits that I could find addresses to, and not a single one of them ever acknowledged it, either because they didn't get it or they didn't want to publicize it or what. But it was something that if I had to do it over, I would probably still do it. But the tragic part of it is that the situation hasn't really changed much in all that time.
Outside of your film work, one of my favorite projects of yours is the TV series Erie, Indiana, and in particular the finale where the lead character wakes up in our world and finds himself surrounded by the actors who look like his friends in his world being the actors who play them in our world. And it's funny because that totally preempts the late 90s, 2000s, sort of cinema trend of meta movies like The Truman Show and the work of Charlie Kaufman. And yet your series didn't seem to get nearly as much attention at the time as it deserved.
Well, unfortunately, Erie, Indiana, which I had a wonderful time working on, was the victim of really, really bad time slotting in America. And it was opposite a show called 60 Minutes, which is the most popular news show in America. And it just never recovered from its bad ratings at the beginning. It did go for two seasons, but it kept getting moved around, and then it wasn't here the 1 week, and then it was now on Thursday, and it was, you know, it was the classic where is my show kind of thing. Oddly enough, after the show had run, it was revived several years later on the Fox channel on Saturday mornings, and it started to get tremendous ratings from kids who weren't up at 7:30 at night or were busy doing something else. And it started to catch on. And it caught on to a degree where they went, oh, my God, there's only 18 episodes of this. We better get some more episodes. So they, on the cheap, went to Canada, rebuilt the sets. Now, the kids were too old to play the same parts. So they had to do, they cobbled together an episode where, using footage from the old show, the two lead kids zap into another dimension where they appear as other children in the same set, now in Canada, with different parents. And that's part of the strangeness of where we are. Yeah. Anyway, these shows, unfortunately, were very, very cheaply produced, and not nearly as good as any of the shows that we had done, which, by the way, were cheaply produced. And so they did a bunch of episodes, but it killed it because the episodes were terrible. So now it's not on television at all. The original 18 episodes are available on some sort of DVD package, which was pretty bad quality, frankly, because the shows were never – they were shot on film, but they were cut on tape, and they were never – the negatives were never cut. So it's one of those situations where – a tape source has to keep getting upgraded years and years after year, you know, and the Blu-ray, forget it. You know, I mean, there's no way that this kind of material is ever going to look that good anymore. And so it may just end up being a footnote in television history, but it does have a lot of fans, and there's a lot of kids who really did like it, and I thought it was an excellent show.
And can I ask you if you're going to be returning to directing anytime soon? Because there's been some rumors on the internet lately that you might be doing Gremlins 3, indeed Gremlins 3D.
Yeah, that's exactly what you said it is. It's an internet rumor. I was intrigued myself, and I took it upon myself to call Warner Brothers and say, are you guys doing anything with Gremlins 3? No, they weren't. They're not interested right now. And I'm sure that when they do it, they're not going to want me. They're going to want to get some younger guy, and they're going to want to reimagine the whole thing. And probably it's not going to be Gremlins 3. It's going to be new Gremlins. And they'll probably go back to the source or do a prequel or do something that they can, you know, because they can't use the same actors anymore. And the designs and stuff are puppet. You know, it's all puppetry. And puppetry isn't very popular anymore. So I think they'll find some CG application to do another Gremlins movie, but apparently it's not going to happen right away.
Okay. And then as for you, have you got any directing projects coming up?
I have a lot of directing projects. I don't know if any of them are coming up. I mean, it's all about financing today. It's all about going around and asking for money, begging, basically. I there's another picture called Bat Out of Hell that I was scheduled to do, or it said, and that never happened. So it's still there, and people keep asking me about it. And it's like, no, it's not happening. And then I have some projects of my own that I'm trying to get off the ground, and I fly back and forth to Europe to try to get money. And if you get money, then you get an actor, but you lose the actor, then you don't get the money. And it's all sort of high finance kind of a thing that's not really my forte. So I'm sure I will rise again. And I do have my 3D movie that's ostensibly coming out at some point.
Cool.
I'm still here, still in the game.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
If you'd like to see Joe's classic horror film Piranha, which is receiving its second sequel, Piranha 3D, in cinemas this summer, there's a screening tomorrow, Saturday the 1st of May, at lunchtime, at the Odeon Covent Garden on Shaftesbury Avenue. For more info about that and the rest of CineXS, please visit their website, www.cine-xs.co.uk. That's CINE-EXCESS. And to find out more regarding Brunel University's Cult Film Archive and MA course, which accompany the CineXS Festival, please visit www.brunel.ac.uk/cult. That's brunel.ac.uk/cult. And I'd like to thank Xavier Mendick and Helen Jacobus at Brunel University for setting up my interview with Joe Dante. As well as CineXS, there's another fantasy film festival also taking place in London this weekend at the Apollo Piccadilly Cinema on Lower Regent Street, and I'm involved in programming the comic book theme events at the festival. Tomorrow, Saturday the 1st of May, I'm hosting panels on 60 years of Dan Dare and British superhero comics with some of this country's finest creators, and throughout the weekend there are premieres and classic screenings of the best science fiction films from around the world, including on Saturday night at midnight a screening of a Rutger Hauer B-movie with a live new soundtrack performed by improv comedians, including the actor Dean Hagland from The X-Files. And then on Sunday the 2nd of May, I'm also hosting a panel on 5 decades of Doctor Who, featuring directors and writers of the show, including the director of the first Dalek serial from 1964, and that follows a free screening of the Peter Cushing and Bernard Cribbins movie, Daleks Invasion Earth, 2150 AD. For more info, please visit the website www.sci-fi-london.com. Thanks for listening.